Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, reading for the Western Magazine Hour. Some of our publications, like True West, are going to bi-monthly or even quarterly issues, and as they reduce the number of times per year they print, we're looking for other Western magazines that we can bring you. I'll be reading you a new magazine for the first time on this episode. This is Wild West Magazine, Spring 2024 edition. Gunfighters and lawmen, riding with Sundance. Etta Place is the name this young woman went by when romantically linked to the Sundance Kid of Butch Cassidy infamy, but much about her remains a mystery. By Chuck Lyons. Who was Etta Place? She was the lover and perhaps wife of Pennsylvania-born Harry Alonzo Longabaugh, a.k.a. the Sundance Kid, and a peripheral associate of the Wild Bunch, the outlaw gang headed up by Robert Leroy Parker, a.k.a. Butch Cassidy. But little is known about her origins and less about what happened to her after Sundance and Butch were killed in South America. Larry Poynter, author of the 1977 book In Search of Butch Cassidy, wrote that Etta's identity is one of the most intriguing riddles in Western history. Place was likely born in 1878 and as an adult was described as having classic good looks, with a nice smile and a refined bearing, a description confirmed by a full-length portrait of her and Longabaugh, some say the couple's wedding picture, taken in February 1901 at Joseph B. DeYoung's photo studio at 815 Broadway in New York City. She spoke in an educated manner and knew how to handle a rifle. She had met Longabaugh a year or two earlier and may have been involved in some of the Wild Bunch robberies, scoping out a bank in advance, or holding the group's horses during a heist. But the New York City picture, historian Tom Hatch wrote in his 2013 book, The Last Outlaws, hints of proper high teas, Central Park carriage rides, and evenings at the theater. Even her name is probably false. Place was the maiden name of Longabaugh's mother, Annie, and Sundance sometimes used the alias Harry Place. It has been suggested she took to using the first name Etta in South America after Spanish speakers mispronounced Ethel, which may or may not have been their actual first name. The Pinkertons variously referred to her as Ethel, Ava, Rita, Etta, and Betty Price. In a letter to a friend, David Gillespie, shortly after the gang's June 2, 1899 train robbery near Wilcox, Wyoming, Longabaugh enclosed a copy of the portrait of himself in Place, whom he described as his wife and a Texas lady. The Pinkertons, who spent a lot of time and effort pursuing the Wild Bunch, always believed Etta was from Texas, which fits with her noted skills with horses and firearms. In 1906, William Pinkerton, his detectives having traced Place to Fort Worth, asked that city's police chief to find out who this woman is. Based on the theory Etta's real name was Ethel and she hailed from Texas, researcher Donna Ernst compiled a list of all women named Ethel born in or around Fort Worth and San Antonio between 1875 and 80. Over time, she eliminated each as a contender for the youthful Etta Place, except one. That one was Ethel Bishop, who resided with four other women in what was probably a brothel near notorious Madam Fanny Porter's San Antonio Pleasure Palace, a known Wild Bunch hangout. Another oft-repeated story suggests Butch rescued Etta from a brothel when she was 16. Longabaugh biographer Ed Kirby believes Place was the daughter of one Emily Jane Place of Oswego, New York, who was related somehow to Sundance's mother. Still others have suggested Etta was in fact Colorado rancher Ann Bassett, a Wild Bunch associate known to have vied with Sister Josie for Cassidy's affection. Could Bassett have won Sundance's attentions as well? Probably not. By 1903, Bassett had married Hiram High Henry Bernard, and that same year was arrested, and later acquitted, on a charge of cattle rustling while Place was in South America. On February 20th, 1901, after posing for their portrait, Place and Longobaugh boarded HMS Herminius in New York, disembarking in Buenos Aires, Argentina, on March 23rd. Traveling with them was Cassidy, using the alias James Ryan, and claiming to be Etta's brother. In 1902, Place and Longobaugh returned briefly stateside for Etta to seek treatment of an unknown disease, and again in 1904, when Pinkerton operatives believed she visited family in Texas. In 1906, Place returned stateside for keeps, possibly due to her illness. Sundance returned to South America, where most historians believe he and Butch died in a 1908 shootout with soldiers in Bolivia. Meanwhile, Etta vanished. Several researchers have suggested she became a brothel operator in Fort Worth under the name Eunice Gray. But in an article in the October 2010 Wild West, Donna Humphrey Donnell noted she had seen an alleged portrait of the young Gray, and the woman in that photo definitely was not the same woman seen in the famous New York City portrait of Etta Place and the Sundance Kid. In 1909, an unidentified woman fitting Etta's description asked U.S. diplomatic officials in South America for help in obtaining Longobaugh's death certificate, but she never returned to his office. At most, however, the incident only proves that Place was alive in 1909. Other theories have since surfaced that Etta was the wife of legendary boxing promoter Tex Rickard, that she relocated to Paraguay and remarried, that Longobaugh had survived the 1908 shootout in Bolivia and lived happily ever after with Place in Alaska, that Etta died in the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, or that she was either killed during a domestic dispute or took her own life in Argentina in the 1920s. In 1970, Cassidy's sister, Lula Parker Bettison, told the Los Angeles Times reporters that her brother had not been killed in Bolivia as thought, and that Etta had lived out her days as a schoolteacher in Denver. In the end, speculation, guesswork, and coincidence aside, we only know for certain she was a pretty woman who once carried on a romance with the Sundance Kid and then disappeared from the pages of history. Nothing more. To this day, similarly incredible tales circulate about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, stories relating their escape from the Bolivian gunfight and their subsequent lives of anonymity in various locales out west or in South America. Like the theories surrounding Etta Place, though, they are unsubstantiated and probably false, but tempting. Wild West Magazine, Spring 2024 Edition. Pioneers and Settlers, Leaving the Stage. Showman and Colorado native son Frank Miller was justifiably proud of his 1874 Abbott Downing mud wagon, though by the time of this 1930s parade in Fort Collins, it required a lift to take part. Showman Frank Miller rescued the former mail coach, rode it to the Wild West in fame, and, in the wake of tragedy, donated it as a legacy for future generations. By Catherine Vanessa. Center stage in a northern Colorado museum is an unmistakable symbol of the West. Faint lettering on the driver's box of the historic stagecoach reads U.S. Mail, attesting to its original purpose, while covering nearly every square inch of its woodwork are scrawled signatures, hinting at its raucous second career in Wild West shows. Among the signatures is that of down-home humorist Will Rogers. While it can prove challenging to chisel facts from Western love, this coach and its storied past endures, thanks to Frank C. Miller Jr. The sharpshooter turned Wild West showman once described how he acquired the coach. In the late 80s and 90s, it was on the Bill Show, meaning the Buffalo Bill Circus, on his many tours. But as it became so old that it would not stand up under the hard knocks required of Indian holdups, it was traded for a more modern model. I fought hundreds of Indian battles from the top of the coach myself on the shows. European royalty rode on the coach, as well as Teddy Roosevelt and President William Howard Taft. And I believe you will still find Will Rogers' name written on the back. When the new coach was put into use, I bought the old coach from Cody and sent it home and have owned it ever since. Built in 1874 by the Abbott Downing Company of Concord, New Hampshire, the light coach is more correctly called a mud wagon. A basic, unglamorous conveyance, it was made to transport passengers and mail over rough-hewn trails. Given the lack of a paper trail tying the wagon to either Miller or Cody, it's difficult to verify Frank's story. He may have glossed over facts, but a kernel or two of truth remains. A renowned marksman, trick shooter, and roper, Miller claimed to have toured with Cody in Europe, though which tour is unknown. As he was 40 years younger than Buffalo Bill, Frank probably would have been too young to join any but one of Cody's last European tours between 1902 and 06. The mud wagon would have been retired by that time, as period advertising featured the Wild West's more elegant Concord stage with its higher profile and oval body. Dubbed the Deadwood Stagecoach, the latter is on exhibit at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody, Wyoming. Franklin Carl Miller Jr. was the third of four children born to immigrant parents. His Danish father and Swedish mother had independently followed the promise of gold to the north-central Colorado mining settlement of Black Hawk, where they married in 1876. Later, moving to the growing frontier town of Fort Collins, where Frank was born on May 11, 1886. The Millers prospered, running a saloon, a mercantile store, and later a garage. Taking a page from Cody, showman Frank became a skilled self-promoter. Local newspapers are peppered with notices of his performances, dinner guests, and encounters with notable figures, including a visit to Cody's foster son, Johnny Baker. Miller worked for Zach Mulhall's Wild West show and headlined with the Irwin Brothers' Cheyenne Frontier Days Wild West, which billed him as the most marvelous marksman in the United States. When that show closed in 1917, Frank bought a ranch northwest of Fort Collins and married Florence Peggy Liddle, a gal who loved the spotlight as much as he did. She performed on horseback, crooning songs, and they adopted a son, Franklin, who went by Teddy. Naming their spread Trails End, the Millers developed it into a dude ranch, offering fishing, western entertainment, and a menagerie of trained wild animals, including bears and wolves. Newspapers announced regular visits from such celebrities as humorous Rogers, circus performer and actor Fred Stone, sharpshooter Captain A.H. Hardy, and novelist Rex Beach. Miller held performances both on the ranch and in neighboring towns. Central to his show was the mud wagon, which he rode in parades and hold-up reenactments. When the wagon deteriorated, he had it loaded onto a flatbed trailer and performed from atop that. Just when his show seemed to peak, Miller's life went into a tailspin. First, wife Peggy left him. Next, at the tail end of the Great Depression, he lost Trails End to bankruptcy. Finally, the unthinkable happened. In 1946, son Teddy, who had joined the army, was killed in a motor pool fire while stationed in occupied Berlin. He was 19. It was at that low point the mud wagon, among Teddy's favorite family keepsakes, took on new meaning. As a memorial to his son and the six other soldiers killed in the fire, a grief-stricken Miller presented the coach to the city. It was initially housed in a small purpose-built brick building with a viewing window. Today, most of the 150-plus visible signatures on the coach are difficult to read or trace, and many bearing earlier dates are questionable. While there is no way to verify the validity of Rogers' signature on the upper left rear panel, neither can it be discounted. Miller and the humorist certainly knew each other. Most other signatures appear to be those of tourists or perhaps Trails End visitors or show hands. Most date between the 1910s and 40s and represent citizens of states across the West and Midwest. Miller lived out his life in Fort Collins's Linden Hotel, across the street from the red sandstone building that once housed the family saloon and store. In exchange for his room and board, he painted Western scenes and visited schools, regaling young listeners with stories of the Old West and his encounters with Cody and Rogers. On November 21st, 1953, Miller, 67, died of a heart attack. In the mid-1990s, Miller's memorial mud wagon underwent conservation. It has since been housed at the Fort Collins Museum of Discovery, where it symbolizes the many facets of the Old West. With its ties to mail and passenger service, Wild West performances, and perhaps even showman Cody and humorist Rogers, the mud wagon has gained the celebrity Miller had long envisioned. Wild West Magazine, Spring 2024 Edition. Art of the West, Scenes from the Edge. To depict the frontier era with authenticity, David Wright walks in the footsteps of the mountain men who lived it. By Ted Franklin Ballew. A historian with a brush and palette, David Wright considers it his mission to depict America's frontier era with precision. "We historical artists march to a different drummer," explains Wright. DavidWrightHart.com. From his studio in Gallatin, Tennessee. "We tell a story. It's our obligation to future generations to paint our subjects with as much accuracy as possible." Wright's insistence on authenticity has found him riding Wyoming's Wind River Range on horseback and hunting moose on Canada's Alno Peninsula, dressed in brain-tanned buckskins and bearing a frontiersman's guns and accoutrements. "Such experiences enable me to see things from a much clearer perspective than if I were just using past masters like Alfred Jacob Miller, George Catlin, and Carl Bodmer as references," he explains. "Landscapes, rifles, bead and quill work, or Indian tattoos, I want it to be historically dead on." His quest draws him to museums and archives, while his home reference library is also extensive. "The cliche, the more I learn, the less I know, really is true," he says. "As long as I am a student of history, I'll never quit learning." Rosine, Kentucky, the birthplace of Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass, was a country hamlet when Wright was born there in 1942. Idyllic remembrances of flint ridges, cornfields, and tobacco rows flood his memories. "My first interests were hunting and fishing, and have been all my life." Always he drew, aided by his mother's creativity. "Mom would lay a sheet of paper on her lap and draw," Wright recalls. "Then she would take his hand and trace the sketches." At age 9, he won a local art show. After high school, he took classes at a Nashville advertising school, then studied watercolor in Italy. The latter move, ironically, kindled his interest in the frontier when he spied a 1777 French musket for sale, bought it, and fired it. The flintlock smoke and flash awakening latent nostalgia. By 1962, Wright was back stateside, drawing for the Nashville Banner and Nashville Tennessean until drafted into service in Vietnam. In 1964 and 65, he flew more than 100 missions as the door gunner on Bell UH-1 Iroquois, a.k.a. Huey, helicopters. While in country, he sketched everyone from school children to Montagnard Highlanders and soldiers, though never combat scenes. "Life changes your outlook on things," the artist says. On returning home, Wright resumed commercial artwork while freelancing on the side. He experienced another awakening when he joined the rugged fraternity of the American Mountain Men, further sparking his interest in the fur trade as he dressed the part and learned frontier skills. "Utilizing the day's firearms and tools gives me an edge in seeing what the lives of our frontier forebears were like," he explains. "I know what it's like to build a cabin, split rails, hunt with a flintlock, and be freezing in buckskins. I know how wool feels in a snowstorm and how wet leather clings to you." Wright's first mountain man portrait for Greystone Press sold out. Encouraged, he shifted his focus to portrayals of heroic frontier figures. By 1978, he was following his own muses and garnering national acclaim. The Idle George Museum in Indianapolis has devoted an expansive retrospective to Wright's work and recognized him with several awards. The Booth Western Art Museum in Cartersville, Georgia, named him an artist of excellence. His art also hangs in Nashville, Tennessee's State Museum and the Visitor Center of Kentucky's Cumberland Gap National Historical Park. The Hamilton Collection commissioned Wright to render a series of four collector plates depicting American Indian women. "It is pleasing to be accepted in such a widespread market," says the artist. Still, every season finds Wright in the woods, sometimes alone, sometimes with kindred spirits, reliving some footnote of frontier history to preserve in photos, sketches, and mental images to inform his paintings. "Every day is a blessing," says the artist turned mountain man. Make the most of it. Wild West Magazine, Spring 2024 Edition. Indian Life. When the Wild West meets the Far East. In 1901, as the Boxer Rebellion stole headlines from his Wild West, Buffalo Bill had his Sioux performers don Chinese garb and portray the rebels. By David McCormick. Fresh from robbing the Deadwood stagecoach, the Sioux performers of Buffalo Bill's Wild West changed into loose-fitting Chinese garb and attached long single braids to the backs of their heads, mimicking the clothing and hairstyle of the Boxers, then rebelling halfway around the world. Thus was the stage set for the Western Easterners to man a wall and defend their position against U.S. Army reenactors in a scene played out in Cody's Rescue at Pekin. Pittsburgh was the host city this day in late May 1901, and the big city crowd did not disappoint. As the action unfolded, spectators stomped their feet so hard as to send vibrations through the grandstand. During the climactic scene, as the Army reenactors scaled the artificial wall, the jingoistic roar from audience members swelled to ear-throbbing intensity, and they surged over the railings to join performers on the arena floor. The drama depicted actual events of the ongoing 1899 to 1901 Boxer Rebellion. Emerging as a violent response to increasing foreign incursion into China, the Boxers, nicknamed for their martial arts skills, though officially known as the Society of Righteous and Harmonious Fists, sought to eradicate all signs of modern progress, railroads, telegraph lines, etc., and called for the liquidation of foreigners, particularly Christian missionaries and their Chinese converts. On June 20, 1900, the Boxers besieged foreign embassies in the Legation Quarter of Peking, present-day Beijing, trapping within its walls nearly 500 foreign civilians, 400 military personnel, and 3,000 Chinese Christians. 55 days into the scene, eight nations, including the United States, sent some 20,000 soldiers to relieve the siege. In battle that August 14th and 15th, they defeated the Boxers and then divided the capital city into occupation zones, sending occasional punitive forays into the countryside. Not until September 7th, 1901, did representatives of the Allied nations and China's Qing Empire sign the Boxer Protocol, officially ending the rebellion. Enter the savvy showman. Cody was quick to draw a correlation between the Boxers and American Indians. As the rebels had resisted foreign incursion, he reasoned, so Plains Indians had resisted the westward tide of Anglo settlement, cutting telegraph lines, attacking railroad crews, and battling U.S. soldiers. Fueled by superstitious ideology, the Boxers believed they could induce spirits to enter their bodies and render them invulnerable to bullets, much like the Plains Indian adherents of the Ghost Dance movement believed their ceremonial shirts would protect them. The latter movement ended in tragedy on December 29, 1890, with the Battle-Turned-Massacre at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, all but ending the American Indian Wars. Buffalo Bill was a stickler for the authentic whenever possible, employing real soldiers, cowboys, and Indians performing with real weapons. But as he had no access to real boxers, the duty fell to those Sioux already in Cody's employ. They were perfect for the role, one New York Sun reporter quipped, as they were used to dying in each show. They die in the cowboy battles about the immigrant wagon, and they die again in the chase of the Deadwood coach, he wrote. They made no objection to dying the death of boxers this year. A New York Evening Sun reporter noted, tongue-in-cheek, some of them seemed a little ill at ease in their Chinese makeup, but they kept themselves entirely in the landscape, positively refused to scalp a single member of the Allied forces, and never even indulged in so much as the ghost of a war whoop. American Indians had long featured in promotions for the Wild West, which urged potential ticket buyers to come see the horde of war-painted Arapaho, Cheyenne, and Sioux Indians, though after convincing the infamous Hunk Papa Lakota leader Sitting Bull to tour with him in 1885, Cody had hired only Sioux from the Pine Ridge Agency. Why did Plains Indians, who had violently resisted foreign incursion, agree to perform in the Wild West shows? For starters, those working for Buffalo Bill earned a decent wage, while employment prospects on and around the reservations were limited. In addition, room, board, and travel were free. Finally, performers' immediate families were welcome to join them on tour. In the fall of 1900, drawn like so many Americans by the dramatic events in China, Cody proposed to his theatrical manager, Nate Salisbury, that they incorporate a reenactment of the Allied victory over the Boxers in the forthcoming season of the Wild West. The pair put their heads together and came up with The Rescue at Peking. On April 2, 1901, opening night, they debuted the Chinese-themed spectacle at New York's Madison Square Garden. After a fortnight's run, Cody took the show on the road, and by the time the season wrapped in late October, the troupe had performed in arenas from upstate New York to the South and across much of the Midwest. In 1902, with few changes to the program, Cody and company performed for audiences in the western half of the country. The twice-daily shows were an enormous draw, attracting on average some 20,000 to 30,000 patrons, not counting those turned away at the gate. The audience often exceeded the population of the host cities, as people from surrounding areas packed the stands. The June 4th edition of Pennsylvania's Reading Herald reported that crowds began to gather in the early morning, by showtime transforming into a great huddled mass. As the battle between the boxers and the soldiers marked the grand finale of each performance, Cody and Salisbury spared no expense. It was indeed an enormous and costly undertaking, author John R. Haddad writes, requiring 100 horses, large amounts of gunpowder and explosives, the latest in cannons and firearms, and, of course, the massive wall of Peking that loomed majestically over one end of the arena. The cast alone, including the braided Sioux boxers, numbered 500. The performance lacked for nothing. Whether it was authentically cast or accurate in every detail was beside the point. Cody and company were, above all else, entertainers, and whether clad in Western buckskins or Chinese silks, they seldom disappointed the huddled masses. Wild West Magazine, Spring 2024 Edition. Bravissimo, Buffalo Bill! Showman Cody delighted Italian fans by bringing his Wild West across the ocean blue in 1890 and again in 1906. By Lorenzo Bruscato. To this day, virtually everyone in the United States has heard of William Frederick Buffalo Bill Cody. Even those not expert or passionate about the Western frontier era recognize him as one of the most iconic figures of American history. Buffalo Bill also remains fairly well known throughout Europe, for the Iowa-born scout-turned-showman extraordinaire brought his Wild West across the Atlantic Ocean 8 times, 4 times between 1887 and 92, and 4 more between 1906 and 06. In arenas across the Old World, Honored guests and paying patrons alike filled the stands to thrill at buckskinned cowboys taming wild horses, war-bonneted Indians attacking stagecoaches, soldiers on horseback waging mock battles, and eagle-eyed women and men showing off their shooting prowess. Among the countries to embrace Cody was Italy. Judging by period newspapers, photographs, and the surviving statements of spectators, quite a few cities on the Italian peninsula were afflicted by the fever of the West. Buffalo Bill's Wild West came to Italy twice, during his second European tour in 1890 and during his third European tour in 1906. The first time his caravan of wagons, bearing hundreds of employees and animals, made just six stops. Popular demand swelled the second tour to 119 performances in 37 towns. The basic ticket cost 2 lire, or slightly less than $11 in today's currency. For the best seats, one paid 8 lire, or about $45, not a paltry amount. Most venues hosted two shows a day, one in the late morning, another in the evening. Seldom was there an empty seat in the house. On its first Italian tour, Buffalo Bill's Wild West debuted in Naples on January 26, 1890, for a 22-day run. Journalists were astounded at the appearance of Indians who, until very recently, had been at war. That which may seem to the everyday Neapolitan to be kind of a game, an idle display of skill. One Neapolitan newspaper wrote with a flourish, "is nothing less than a common necessity of everyday life in a country where acrobatic agility, boundless audacity, and prowess are conditions for survival." The highlight of the tour was the 18-day run in Rome, the eternal city, ancient capital of Italy. Its leading citizens welcomed Cody into the most elegant salons, where he impressed with his gentlemanly manners and romantic grace. He set up camp in the Roman meadows near Vatican City after reportedly declaring the crumbling Colosseum unfit for his show. Vatican authorities initially rejected Buffalo Bill's request for an audience with Pope Leo XIII, as his entourage was too large. The showman offered concessions, and on March 3rd, he and a handful of select employees and performers were granted entrance into the Sistine Chapel and met the Pope. An article in the next morning's New York Herald described the meeting as one of the strangest spectacles ever seen within the venerable walls of the Vatican, adding it took place in the midst of the scene of supreme splendor, crowded with the old Roman aristocracy and surrounded with the walls immortalized by Michelangelo and Raphael. American Indians with painted faces, clad in blankets and feathers, and carrying tomahawks and knives must have been an engaging, if disconcerting, sight as they knelt and made the sign of the cross while the Pope blessed them. The newspapers presented Cody's Indian performers, most of whom were Catholic, as civilized, though one Sioux woman reportedly fainted from the excitement as the medicine man sent by the Great Spirit passed by. Other accounts had one of the Sioux greeting the Pope with a war whoop, kneeling to receive the blessing and then rising again with a whoop, enough to either make the Pope slightly pale or wrest an intrigued smile from him. The parties then exchanged gifts. Buffalo Bill presented Leo a bouquet and a garland of flowers mirroring his coat of arms, while the Pope gave Cody rosaries and medals bearing his pontificate. Leo's gifts may have had the desired effect, as on June 9, 1917, the day before his own death, Buffalo Bill converted to Catholicism. "It has been a much greater success than we had hoped for," Cody said of the stopover in the capital. They said they had not had so great excitement in Rome since the days of Titus. On March 12th, the Wild West began an 8-day run in Florence, where, despite poor weather, ticket holders from towns as widely scattered as Siena, Empoli, Livorno, Pisa, Pontesive, Prato, and Pistoia packed the amphitheater. The show also hit Bologna, Milan, and Verona. One day in mid-April, Buffalo Bill and his top-billing sharpshooter, Annie Little Shot Oakley, hired a carriage and went to Venice, where an uncharacteristically nervous Oakley balked at riding a gondola. An Indian remained ashore with her as a bodyguard while Cody and others hopped aboard to take in such timeless sights as the 11th century St. Mark's Basilica, a cathedral housing the remains of the namesake evangelist and gospel writer, and the 14th century Doge's Palace, a one-time residence for the dukes who ruled Venice between 726 and 1797, and whom Cody compared to the U.S. presidents. Back ashore, the reunited party ate fried fish. After performing in Paris in 1905, Cody's globe-trotting show, rebranded as Buffalo Bill's Wild West and Congress of Rough Riders of the World, opened its second Italian tour in Genoa on March 14, 1906. Other tour stops included Rome, Florence, Milan, Naples, Bologna, Turin, Livorno, Pisa, Parma, Ravenna, Verona, Como, and two dozen other towns. For one day only, April 27th, the troupe performed in Asti, this author's small hometown. The tour closed May 11th in Udine. Some may argue for Trieste 4 days later, but that Italian town on the far northeastern border was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire until 1918. Promoters in Rimini, on the Adriatic coast of northern Italy, put up a massive poster to advertise the show's April 11th tour stop. It worked like a charm, drawing a crowd of more than 10,000 to the two-hour performance. On April 21st, the show stopped in Pietronese town of Alessandria, again bringing a flood of spectators eager to see the drama of the American frontier come to life. Although Alessandria's population numbered just 7,000, the two Saturday shows packed the stands with 30,000 ticket holders. Weeks in advance of the show's arrival in Turin, capital of the northwestern Piedmont region, local newspapers ran daily dispatches about the Wild West. Colonel Cody spared nothing to let the people of Turin know that the arrival of his crew and staging operations constituted an interesting spectacle in and of themselves, wrote La Gazzetta del Popolo on April 5th. 2 weeks later, the paper shared another breathless tease. The celebrity of the plains, the king of all, will reproduce among us the deeds accomplished across the American continent, will show himself in the ability to kill the Sioux, and will end the show with the apotheosis of peace and the dance of the nations. When the show finally rolled into Turin on April 22nd, the wagons, livestock, and most performers encamped on a sprawling tract of 40,000 square acres, while Cody himself and other troupe members stayed in town on Via del Palazzi, Furrier Street. The latter district's delighted residents took to singing a rhyming refrain in Corsican dialect. Ali, ali, anduma abeli, chide, America, avia, did please, which roughly translates to, come on, come on, let's go dance, now that America is in Furrier Street. Buffalo Bill reportedly liked the tune so much that he sang it during the final performance in Turin. After wrapping up his tour of Italy in mid-May, the Wild West headed east to Austria, the Balkans, Hungary, Romania, and Ukraine before returning through Poland and Bohemia, the present-day Czech Republic, Germany, and Belgium. By the time Buffalo Bill gave his farewell performance of the 1906 season in Ghent on September 21st, he'd become an international celebrity, and kids on street corners across Europe were playing cowboys and Indians. Buffalo Bill's tours of Italy certainly had a profound and lasting influence on the Italian vision of the American West. Think spaghetti westerns and replica firearms. Cody himself, however, had only tenuous connections to Italy. On March 6, 1866, the 20-year-old Union Army teamster had married Missouri native Luisa Ferrucci, 1844 to 1921. But her family had roots in the Lorraine region of northeastern France. Buffalo Bill did name his favorite Springfield model 1866 trapdoor rifle Lucretia Borgia, but that is thought to have been a lark. the illegitimate daughter of a future pope, the namesake Italian noblewoman rose to prominence during the Renaissance. Rumored to have poisoned several lovers, Lucrezia Borgia was both beautiful and deadly. Likely hearing her name in passing, and doubtless regarding his Springfield as beautiful and deadly, at least to elk and bison, Cody had Borgia's name inscribed on the rifle's lock plate. What remains of the rifle is on display at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West in Cody, Wyoming. When he set out in the entertainment world, Cody appeared on stage with Giuseppe Morlacci, 1836-86, a celebrated prima ballerina and popular dancer from Milan, who made her American debut in New York City in October 1867. By December 1872, she had joined the cast of dime novelist Ned Buntline's touring Western melodrama, Scouts of the Prairie, co-starring Buffalo Bill and fellow scout John Baker, Texas Jack Omohundro, whom Morlacci would marry the following summer. Another Italian, Naples-born photographer Carlo Gentile, snapped and sold promotional cartes de visite of cast members, while his adopted Apache son appeared on stage. In 1873, Buntline left the troupe, and Cody enlisted friend James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, to join the aspiring showman, Morlacci and Texas Jack, in a new touring play called Scouts of the Plains. The production served as a training ground for Buffalo Bill's Wild West and his later success, Across the Ocean Blue. Wild West aficionado and artist Lorenzo Broascuto hails from Asti in the Piedmont region of Northwest Italy. For further reading, he recommends 4 Years in Europe with Buffalo Bill by Charles Eldridge Griffin, as well as the Italian language books Buffalo Bill in Italia by Mario Busoni and Quando Buffalo Bill Venne in Italia by Nicola Tonelli. Here's a sidebar that accompanies the previous story. Hard as Butteri. Italy's answer to the American cowboy, the Buttero, is the traditional horseback wrangler of horses or cattle from the west central coast, stretching from Rome and the surrounding Lazio region north into Tuscany. The Buttero sits a broad wooden saddle known as a bardella in Lazio or a scaffarda in Tuscany. He typically wears moleskin trousers, leather leggings, a velvet jacket, and a broad-brimmed hat, and packs up pastrano, greatcoat, as protection from the weather. To motivate stubborn livestock, he wields a long stick known as a mazzarella, from the Italian word for mace. With the disappearance of large estates and a corresponding decline in the horseback management of livestock, the need for working butteri has disappeared. But they remain popular figures in cultural events, serve as equestrian tourism guides, and participate in European sporting events similar to rodeos. Like their American counterparts, Buteri thrive on competition. On March 8, 1890, in the Prati di Castello district of central Rome, Wild West showman Buffalo Bill Cody and Duke Onorato Caetani met to settle a bet. Caetani had been boasting that his Buteri were tougher than Buffalo Bill's Bronco Busters. Cody wagered 1,000 lire that neither Augusto Imperaldi, boss Butero of the Caetani Estates, nor any of the 8 Buteri he had brought with him that day would be able to ride a wild Mustang to a standstill within the allotted time limit of 5 minutes. After the first Butero ran long, Imperaldi himself leaped from the stands into the saddle. Within a few minutes, he was circling the arena aboard the subdued American Mustang, holding the reins loosely in his right hand and waving his hat overhead with his left, to the wild cheering of Italian spectators. A statue of Imperaldi still graces his central Italian hometown of Cisterna di Latina, where he is buried. Citing the failure of the first Butero, Buffalo Bill disputed the results and paid only half the bet. The contest inspired Italian director Giuseppe Accattino's 1949 film Buffalo Bill in Rome, among the earliest of the spaghetti westerns. Set in Rome, 1890, the plot centers on a Wild West cowboy named Red, who romances a local girl named Lolita, much to the annoyance of her fiancé, a butero. The fiancé and fellow buteri challenge Buffalo Bill and hands to a race, which, predictably, the Americans lose. Here is a second sidebar to the previous story. Fascist gun in the West? In the wake of Buffalo Bill Cody's death on January 10, 1917, his enduring popularity in Italy spawned a bizarre epilogue with diplomatic ramifications. In 1920, Florence-based publisher Casa Editrice Nerbini, present-day Edizioni Nerbini, launched a children's illustrated adventure series entitled Buffalo Bill, the Hero of the Wild West. Within a few years, Benito Mussolini's fascist regime rose to power, and by the 1930s, it was Italianizing every aspect of national culture, including the heroes of such illustrated children's stories. After Italy declared war on the United States in 1941, Two Deuce became particularly determined to do away with all flattering references to Americans. Kowtowing to the regime's demands, Nerbini rewrote the backstory of its Buffalo Bill, claiming Cody was in fact an Italian immigrant named Domenico Tobini. Hailing from Romagna, Mussolini's native region, the Italian Cody was said to have adopted the moniker Buffalo Bill, not from his skill at shooting bison, but because he initially immigrated to the city of Buffalo, New York. Who knew? Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading articles from the November 2022 edition of True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier. This article is the cover article from the November edition, Hellraisers and Trailblazers, by Jana Bommersbach and Bob Bowes-Bell. The Real Women of the Wild West, the Queen of the Colorado Red Light District. Jenny Rogers was a tall drink of water, as they used to say, standing at 6 feet tall. She had gone through several names and marriages before she landed in Denver wearing her trademark pair of emerald earrings. She purchased her first house from Maddie Silks in 1880. At 1942 Market Street, she opened the House of Mirrors, which was known as the most opulent and infamous brothel in Denver. She became notorious and even better known when she caught her husband in the arms of another woman, several months after their wedding in 1887. "I shot him because I love him, damn him," she is quoted as telling the police. Her wounded husband persuaded the authorities to let her go. Death on the Line. Wyatt Earp arrived in Tombstone with his second wife, Maddie, who he later abandoned for the live-in girlfriend of Johnny Behan. Maddie returned to her former profession as a soiled dove and ended up in Pinal, Arizona, where she took an overdose of laudanum on July 3, 1888, per her grave marker. Before she died, she confessed, "Wyatt Earp ruined my life." The Notorious Sadie Marcus. A teenage runaway, Sadie, real name Josephine Marcus, landed in Tombstone and shacked up with Cochise County Sheriff Johnny Behan. By 1881, that relationship was over, and she later consummated an affair with Behan's arch-rival, Wyatt Earp. She lived with Earp for 47 years as a common-law wife and outlived him by nearly 16 years. Much like Libby Custer did for her famous husband, George Armstrong, Marcus fiercely protected Earp's reputation. She also tried to cover up her own infamous past in Tombstone. Historians still debate whether or not she had worked as a soiled dove. Did Big Nose Kate have a big nose? One of the enduring mysteries of the Old West history is, where did Doc Holliday's girlfriend, Kate Elder, real name Mary Catherine Haroney, get her nickname? Some say she got it because she couldn't keep her nose out of other people's business. She was nosy. The earliest mention of the nickname is found in Wyatt Earp's article in the San Francisco Examiner, August 2, 1896, how Wyatt Earp routed a gang of Arizona outlaws. In the article, it's plain that Wyatt had no use for Kate, and the feeling was mutual. But here's the rub. No contemporary document or newspaper item has been found that described her as Big Nose Kate. Many historians have made the case that in the photographs of her in old age, she doesn't appear to have a big proboscis. But if you look closely, that is not a button nose. At this late date, the verdict is still out. But if push comes to shove, we think you could make a case that she indeed had a big honker. Etta Place. Etta Place, the beautiful girlfriend of the Sundance Kid, followed the Kid and Butch Cassidy to South America. She appeared in the famous Tea Party photo taken at Cholula, Argentina, but she disappeared sometime before the boys met their doom in Bolivia. Some accounts state that she was a school teacher, but most historians now believe she was actually working in Fanny Porter's brothel in San Antonio when Harry Lagerbaug met her in about 1899. Even her exotic name, Etta, is now thought to have been a typo on a Pinkerton rap sheet and perhaps a corruption of Ethel. Either way, she is now a legendary Old West character. When Charlotte Hall pulled a gun on Grover Cleveland. Okay, it wasn't that Grover Cleveland. It's August of 1911, and Charlotte Hall is again exploring Arizona territory, this time in the Marsh Pass area near Tuba City. An Indian runner finds her and delivers her a telegram that her beloved mother is in the Prescott Hospital. To get to her, Charlotte must intercept the Winslow train. She commandeers a buckboard and a Navajo guide named Grover Cleveland for an all-night dash across roadless terrain, and then was hindered by a violent storm that turned normally dry washes into raging torrents. When Grover refused to cross the swirling water, a most practical and responsible decision, Charlotte pulled a gun on him and demanded they go on. She met the train and got to her mother's bedside. Later, she told her good friend, Alice Hewins of Phoenix, she did not know which he was more afraid of, the road or Charlotte. Stagecoach Mary. She had the temperament of a grizzly bear. She was tough, but not with children. She was bawdy. She was hard-drinking and quick-shooting, and she loved her guns. Still, she was adored by the community who knew her as Stagecoach Mary. Biddy Mason. She was 29 years old, had already endured rape, had three daughters, and knew this was her life forever. And then she was forced to walk with the wagon train 2,000 miles west, and everything changed. Lozen. She was born in the Chihin Chiricahua Apache Band in their spiritual home of Ojo Caliente, between what's now Silver City and Socorro in New Mexico. Like all Apache children, she was trained in the skills of survival, with girls as well as boys, learning to fight, hunt, and ride. But while most girls then went on to marry and raise families, Lozen rejected that role. Instead, she trained as a warrior, like her older brother. The Queen of the Santa Fe Tidbits. Las Tulas won many a Monte game because of her distracting beauty and her ability to read the minds of the men she played against. So, Daedalus, some went into battle wearing long peasant skirts, large straw hats, and a cross bullet belt. Some dressed as men, knowing generals like Pancho Villa resented them. But that didn't stop these soldaderas, these heroines of the Mexican Revolution. They are romanticized under the popular name Adelita, from a former folk song of the Revolution. Petra Pedro Herrera, Angela Angel Jimenez, Amelia Emilio Robles Avila. These women stood out. They all dressed as men and all rose through the ranks of the armies of Zapata, Venustiano Carranza, and even Pancho Villa. Many other soldaderas never saw battle, but played an even more crucial role, joining their men and providing the life support that kept the armies going, finding and cooking food, nursing the wounded. Dilch. She started out her escape journey with two other captives, but they were soon captured. Her meager rations quickly ran out, and she had to subsist on seeds and cactus fruit. She couldn't swim, and yet she got across the Colorado River. She didn't have a map, but she made it to the White Mountains. Chalk it all up to being an Apache. Stubborn, resilient, and resourceful. Amazing. A doomed wagon train. The Oatmans began their ill-fated journey on a wagon train that had some 93 members riding or walking beside 43 wagons bound for the land of Bashan, today known as Yuma. Petty infighting, alternative visions, and illnesses took their toll, so much so that by the time they reached Socorro, New Mexico, their ranks had been cut in half. And by the time they reached the Gila River on the west of the Big Bend in Arizona Territory, the wagons had been reduced to only one. The tragedy that ensued and the captivity of the Oatman girls is reexamined and new truths are revealed. The Great Western. They called her the Great Western after the largest ship then on the sea. She went through a whole variety of names over a lifetime of multiple husbands. A signature piece in the book is this cascading collage of encapsulating and reflecting the real women of the Wild West experience. The book and the art show will premiere on November 4th, 2022 at the Phippen Art Museum in Prescott, Arizona.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.